of weather most of the time. The issue is when you have outlying villages and farms, and particularly when it is quite high up or quite exposed.
But we've always had those. The question is, do you think it's getting worse, though? That's the thing.
I don't think it's necessarily getting worse. I think we have had some pretty poor performances, though, where people have been out for far too long. And that has been something of a wake-up call to, you know, both your power suppliers and the network providers and so on, that, you know, it's no good saying, well, look, I'm terribly sorry, I've got everybody on holiday or whatever, and so they're not going to arrive for another 3 weeks. The reality is that they have got a responsibility. They usually being the people who do the networks to get to you and get to you quickly. And the older you are, to get there faster, if you're ill, to get there faster, there is a hierarchy. And you, assuming people have ticked the appropriate box, which says that they are a priority case, they should get to you quite quickly, it is tricky.
We've probably tried to pack a little bit too much into this programme, but Angela, thank you very much for your wise words. Well, that's it from me today on The Times at One. My brilliant producer was Lizzie Highfield, and Ryan Boyden was my technical operator. Next on Times Radio, Jane Garvin and Fee Glover.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Very slick there at the end, Fee, you've got to say. You hit the jingle at the right. Well done, Tim. Normally gets me.
Five or later.
Right, thank you. Could you make it a tenner, please? Good afternoon. It is 2 o'clock. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio until four.
And in those 2 hours, 50 private schools have closed since VAT was added to fees. We'll find out what this means for the future of private education. Why migration influencers are helping people cheat the UK immigration system. What is a presidential fitness test? And why is Donald Trump, the picture of health, making school children do this? Them. More on Storm Floris, and Laura Hackett will tell us what to read on our August holidays if we've got them.
Let's start with the news at 2 o'clock on Times Radio. Tom Crosdell.
Thanks, Jane. Good afternoon. Storm Floris is hitting the northern half of the UK with gusts of up to 106 miles per hour recorded in northeast Scotland. Parts of the country are under a danger to life weather warning. LNER is telling people not to travel north of Newcastle, while the advice from Avanti West Coast is to avoid services north of Preston. Some of ScotRail's lines are closed, while some flights at Glasgow Airport have been cancelled. 10,000 homes and businesses in the Republic of Ireland are without power. Claire Nazir is a weather presenter.
It's really packing a punch. It's a potent storm. It's broken a few records, that station records, in terms of millibars, how deep it is. And I've just seen a reading across the Cairngorms as well as Alnwick Moor, which is quite a high site, around 4,000 feet, in excess of 100 miles an hour, and that's gusts.
The Israeli army is understood to be planning a new operation that would see forces go into central Gaza to release the remaining hostages being held by Hamas. The IDF has previously avoided such an operation in case it puts those being held captive in danger. But Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says it's clear Hamas doesn't want a deal that would include their release. Ministers say the government is doing the detailed work to crack down on small boat crossings. The Home Secretary has announced an extra £100 million to tackle people smuggling. Some of the money will support the one-in, one-out returns agreement with France. Former Chief Inspector of Borders and Immigration John Vines told Times Radio the pilot is a step in the right direction.
It's good that for the first time, France have accepted the principle that they might take people back to France. Mm. It's not going to act as a deterrent unless the people who are subject of it see a real likelihood that they're going to be returned to France. And if it's penny numbers, then that isn't going to work. So something like that, I think, is essential to try and address the demand issue.
Reform UK's new justice advisers told Times Radio, we're warehousing prisoners and turning out better criminals into our society. Vanessa Frake is calling for better rehabilitation in jails. The government insists it's committed to reducing reoffending. Wazir Youssef heads up Reform's Department of Government Efficiency. He's told Times Radio how he feels about the prospect of a potential election win.
Not worried and not frightened whenever those things, but of course a lot of the leadership at Reform are pretty reluctant politicians in the sense that we've all built careers elsewhere and we're not in this just for a career in politics and to draw a salary. But of course, you know, that responsibility weighs heavy on people's shoulders, including on our leader Nigel's shoulders.
England's cricketers have slipped to a six-run defeat against India in the final test, meaning the series ends in a two-all draw. The hosts needed 35 runs to win on the last day at the Oval, but four wickets in the first hour saw India take victory. England's Harry Brooks says it was hard to take.
Came into the day this morning very confident. Obviously, we had two very good players out there at the time, and yeah, I just thought we were going to easily see it home. And then obviously the way that the Indians fought back there and the way that Siraj bowled especially, I think he deserved every success there.
Chris Wokes played in a sling as England's last batsman. For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app and via your smart speaker.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Hello, good afternoon. 0333 003 2353. That's the WhatsApp. You can get straight through to us. We look at them all. We read some of them out. Not all of them.
Some of them we take home with us in our souls.
We're broken women. Actually, we're not. Don't worry about us. Between now and 4 o'clock, private schools are closing. Why? Is it because of the VAT on private school fees? A big shock in Scotland today, and I'm not talking about the weather. The Deputy First Minister, Kate Forbes, won't be standing at the election next year. She says she doesn't want to miss any more of the precious early years of family life. She does have a three-year-old daughter. And morning sickness in most pregnancies is irritating but bearable. However, some women suffer appallingly and it's very difficult to get help. We'll have more on that later. It's Literary Salon Monday. Laura Hackett is always a very welcome guest. And today she's discussing three novels you might want to seek out over the summer, including a 1961 Iris Murdoch called A Severed Head. And actually, I've read some of the bumf about this novel and I'm not sure I'm drawn to it, but no doubt Laura will be able to sell it to me later.
I think you'd have to combine any Iris Murdoch with something way, way to the kind of bright yellow end of the colouring in book spectrum, Jane. I mean, that's just from the title, it would allude to quite a dark novel. But I think also her books just are quite dark, so it'd be interesting to see what Laura balances that with.
Now, we're thinking of listeners in Scotland today, not just because of the weather. We are going to North Berwick ourselves on Friday. Really looking forward to this. We'll be appearing at the Fringe by the Sea Festival. That's right, isn't it?
That is right.
And we just checked the weather and it's pouring with rain while we're on between 11:30 and 12:30. So we're hoping that the tent will be absolutely overburdened with people who don't particularly want to see us but do want to get out of the weather. So we know, by the way, that lots of you have got tickets for that. We're very grateful. Looking forward to seeing you on Friday. But it's just worth saying that our guest there will be Judy Murray, who's talking about her novel. That's why it sprang into my head. The weather legend Jim Dale is going to bring us up to date with the impact of Storm Floris. And we're also just going to be asking, the weather like this in August... Well, it shouldn't be like this in August. It is weird. And it's not just weird here, is it?
So there's snow in Australia. There's been very early for the Alps snow this year as well. And the Nordic regions have had a heat wave, the like of which nobody can remember. So I think it's been over 100 years since Norway has had temperatures of over 30 degrees for more consecutive days, more than 10 consecutive days. So, yes, there's plenty to talk about. And I think, and Jim Dale agrees with us on this point, we have gone beyond that question of could this be to do with climate change and global warming? We accept that it is, but we definitely need to mark everybody's cards about how quickly the changes are coming.
Yeah, it's pretty disturbing, really. And Adam Shaw is with us at around about 4:45. He's our personal finance guru. And today, well, what else can he talk about? He's going to talk about car loans. Could you be in line for compensation? And if so, how do you go about securing it? That's all coming up between now and 4 o'clock. But now, Fee, what are the most read stories on the Times website?
Well, Jane, Susan, in at number three, Jeffrey Epstein sold Prince Andrew's secrets. A new book claims Andrew Lowney writes that the serial sex offender used the Duke of York to access political leaders and sold sold his intimate secrets to foreign intelligence agencies. The second most read story is England versus India live. That is score and updates from the fifth test. Day five, more on that thrilling match in a moment. And the most read piece on the Times website, Salt Path Scandal. Cafe owner disputes book's claims of bullying. This is yet more from the Salt Path. A cafe owner is saying that some of the stuff that has been written about a cafe, it wasn't specifically named in the Salt Path, but could have been easily identified just because there aren't very many large cafes on that coastal path, were really not true to the reality. It is the story that just keeps on giving. You can read all of those.
I just think as August progresses, we're going to hear more and more about it.
Okay.
Even more.
You can read all of those articles on thetimes.com. You do need your digital subscription if you don't have one.
Well, you could get one.
Well done. Go to thetimes.com/subscribe.
9 minutes past two. Once again, the Sunday Times was stolen from my step yesterday morning. If that is you, could you please stop doing it? Right, let's move on with the news of the day. More than 50 private schools have announced they are closing since the government put VAT on fees. Senior figures in private education have told the Times that the policy is driving out pupils and putting schools at risk of collapse. Now, the policy is expected to raise £1.6 billion every year, which Labour says will be reinvested into state education. Let's have a word with Sarah Kinane, who's Director of Communications for the Independent Schools Council. Sarah, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
Tell us then, in a normal year, if there is such a thing, how many private schools might close?
I mean, it differs from year to year. Before COVID, we were seeing around 30 to 35. Now, post-COVID, it was around 40 to 45 mainstream schools. But I think you also need to look at the context behind those numbers. Many of the schools that have closed have been incredibly small. Like, we're talking about student numbers in the single figures, or they were delivering an incredibly niche type of education. And the sorts of schools that we've seen announce their closure since the arrival of VAT have been very different to that. So it's not just about the raw numbers, it's about the type of schools that are disappearing and what that means for families, children and local communities.
Okay, so we need to be a bit careful about this then. To suggest that private education in this country is over, that's simply not true, is it?
No, I don't think anyone's saying that private education is over. Independent education remains a choice for many parents out there. And there are many schools that will weather the storm of VAT and other taxes on education that the government have put on. However, it is also true to say that VAT has proved a bridge too far for many schools. And it's those schools that really people need to worry about, because we're talking not just about children's education, we're talking about local jobs, we're talking about community working. There's so much that is lost when an independent school disappears from the landscape.
And some of these smaller schools serving, as you say, really, really tiny cohorts of pupils, but they were serving a very particular type of child who might struggle to get on in state education or simply in a busier environment. Is that something you're worried about?
Definitely, yes. So within the independent sector, there's a higher rate of children being supported with SEND. So about one in five children within ISC schools has some sort of SEND need that is being met. The majority of those children in ISC schools do not have an EHCP, and so their fees are going to be charged VAT. And it's those families that we really worried about, because as anyone who's had any experience with the SEND system will know, getting things like an EHCP is a very time-intensive, labour-intensive, emotional process. Many families are looking at that and they're choosing instead to invest in an independent education, freeing up state provision for SEND, but also making sure that their child can get the right provision right away.
But of course, Labour won the election. This was their stated policy, and they believe that putting VAT on private school fees will raise over £1.5 billion every year. That will be ploughed into state education. That might mean that state schools are better able to cater for those pupils currently being served by these small private schools. Surely that might very well be the case.
I think that the stats that you cite there very much depend on the government's estimates being right, and we already know that they're wrong by quite some way. So the government estimated that 3,000 children would leave independent education this academic year. Their sums relied on it being a drop of only 3,000. We know from DfE data that in England alone, the drop is much higher. We're talking about over 11,000 children who've been displaced from their schools, which broadly matches what we found in our annual census. So and that fall in independent school numbers is much higher than the demographic shift. So it cannot be explained by, say, a slowing in the birth rate. I think that before the election, you're right, Labour did promise that the money would go towards state schools. But we've seen this promise watered down over the months since VAT was introduced, saying that it would be spent on public services, including schools, and including the Prime Minister tweeting that the money would instead be going towards housing. So there's a real concern that deep damage is being done within independent education without any real benefit for our colleagues in the state who are still facing budget cuts.
What about the truly eye-watering cost of some private schools? The truth is that schools like, I don't know, Eton for boys, Benenden for girls will happily roll on, and they are charging incredible sums of money, over 50 grand a year in the case of Benenden, over 60, I think, for Eton now. There's absolutely no public sympathy for people who will just carry on forking out this money for their children's ultra-privileged education. Why would there be?
I think that when people talk about independent schools, they quite often go to the schools that you've cited there. But actually, there's a huge amount of diversity within independent education. The typical independent school has a couple of hundred pupils. It serves a primary age. And, you know, the smallest school within ISC is a 7-pupil PRU. The fees at
that's a pupil referral unit.
Pupil referral unit, yes. And the fees at an ISC school can be as low as £75 a week. So the idea that the more expensive that are always cited in these sorts of arguments are the norm is very much not the case. But the exception rather than the rule.
My point is that they won't be impacted by this policy at all. They will stay open. They will carry on educating the children of the ultra-rich, who will go on to have, in some cases, you might say, an absurdly prominent role in our public life. They're completely unaffected by this.
I don't think that they are completely unaffected. Not all big schools have the sorts of endowments that some of our schools do. But as well as educating their own children, a lot of our schools do an amazing amount of good within their local community. So I spoke earlier about jobs in local communities. Many of our schools are their area's largest employers. There's vital and valued partnership work with neighbouring state schools and community groups, and bursary provision as well to widen access as far as is possible. And these are just some of the good things that independent schools are doing in their local community that maybe don't get spoken about as much as their fee level.
But there's also the point that if some of these private stroke independent schools wanted to survive, they could just charge less.
I think that that is a misunderstanding of how independent schools are run. So, as I said, the majority of independent schools do just have those couple of hundred pupils. The margins are very tight. A lot of our smaller schools, for example, have really kept the fees as low as they can. Many of our schools charge actually lower than you would find per pupil in the state funding wise. And those are the schools for whom they've already cut back over the past few years, and there is nothing left to cut, especially when you consider that the majority of any school's budget, usually around between 2/3 and 3/4, is spent on staff.
Thank you very much indeed for talking to us. We appreciate it. That is, forgive me, my script has gone bananas. That's Sarah Canane, Director of Communications for the Independent Schools Council. And thanks for your views on this. Tracy says, my daughter was so unhappy in the state sector. She'd been labelled highly gifted and talented, a label we all abhorred. When she moved, made possible through scholarships and our savings to the private sector, she really flourished. There are children at both ends of the so-called special needs spectrum. I do speak as a retired state sector teacher who loved my job, says Tracy. Thank you for that.
We are 0333 003 2353 this afternoon and every afternoon. We're Jane and Fee at times.radio. If you want to bung something on the email, congratulations to a headline of the day. I'm going to see whether or not you can guess it, Jane. This is about the actor and Tom Holland and his fiancée Zendaya trying to get new lead roles. Can you tell what the picture might be so far?
Lead roles. Does it involve a pet?
Yes, they've been photographed taking a dog for a walk in London's Richmond Park with the actress wearing her £200,000 engagement ring. I'm reading here from The Sun. Tom, 29, and 28-year-old Zendaya then went to Glasgow, doubling for New York to shoot the £150 million Spider-Man Brand New Day. So it's a lovely photograph of them out with their respective dogs. I hope they're their dogs anyway. There's no suggestion they just took somebody else's. And the headline is...
No, sorry, I don't know.
You would have been useless. Or was it catchphrase, say what you see?
Yeah, I would have been useless on it, yes.
The headline is, every dog has its Zendaya.
Of course. It's great.
I'm a little bit worried about her jumper, though. It's very bobbly. I think she needs to get one of those nice little kind of mini jumper hoovers that you can get in the magazines, usually right at the back.
Come on, Zendaya, you can afford it, love, surely.
Coming up, we'll get the drama on the final test match between England and India. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio, coming up to 20 minutes past two.
Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel.
How quiet is Britain this summer? We'll investigate the eerie silence of the high streets and even in our pubs.
And if you're packing the car and heading on your summer holiday, let's be honest, your children will probably fight. We'll ask Steve Backshall, the man who's dealt with crocodiles and sharks, about why fighting children is so dangerous.
Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel. Tomorrow morning from 6 on Times Radio.
When you run a small business, you know it's important to keep an eye on your costs. And a smart meter can help. Barry Henderson is the owner of Henderson's Restaurant in Edinburgh and has been using his smart meter as part of his efforts to waste less energy and be more sustainable.
The smart meter definitely has made us more conscious of our energy use, and we can modify our operation to help just be more efficient. As a vegetarian business, lots of our staff are vegetarian and very environmentally conscious, so using energy efficiently is definitely a key core value for us. It's definitely helped us save money, and it's also helped us be more sustainable, able to focus on where we're using electricity and become more efficient. I genuinely do recommend smart meters to other businesses. Like, I think it just gives you a more accurate picture of how you're using electricity and energy.
To find out more, search Get a Smart Meter for Business. Eligibility may vary.
Listen at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
This straight in from Jill. It's about paying for education. Your contributor mentioned the word choice, and that is true. We chose to send our daughter to our local independent high school and didn't even consider applying for a scholarship, which she would have qualified for. I work as a self-employed cleaner on minimum wage, and we sacrifice many things to pay. I would still make the same decision and pay the VAT willingly. Thank you for all of those. Do keep them coming. We will get to texts and messages as often as we can during the programme. Let me tell you about a fantastic offer. The Sunday Times Wine Club has launched a new range of exceptional classic wines called the Exclusive Collection, complete with special artwork designed by their cartoonist, Russell Herneman. Have you got a cartoonist?
Yes, on 24-hour, 7 days a week standby, yes.
Excellent. Well, it's the mark of greatness. You can save up to 20% on individual wines, and Times Radio listeners can save an additional 20% on 3 bottle orders. Just use the code EXCLUSIVE20, that's EXCLUSIVE20, at sundaytimeswineclub.co.uk/exclusive collection, and please do always drink responsibly. The final test between England and India concluded today, taking the series to a 2-2 draw. England needed just 7 runs to win when they were bowled out. Chris Wokes was the last man at the crease, batting one-handed, having dislocated his shoulder earlier on in the match. Here is the final wicket live on TalkSport.
7 to win, 6 to tie. Here is Mohammad Siraj bowling to Atkinson. Bowled in! He's hit the off stump out of the ground! Siraj has won the game and squared the series for India. It was a low full toss which Atkinson missed. He walks slowly to his partner at the other end. Chris Wokes never got to face a ball. Atkinson did his very, very best. But India have won the Test match by 6 runs.
A tempered response. Times Radio's Hugo Chambray joins us now. Hello.
Hello.
Have you enjoyed this particular series?
I have. I think it's been difficult not to as a cricket fan. It's been called by pundits one of the greatest Test series ever played. There's been a lot of niggle and ag on the pitch, which I think just makes sport better. You know, when it's clear the players involved really want to win and, you know, are willing to get in each other's faces and kind of blur the lines of sportsmanship and morality, it's been enjoyable.
So is it then just a little bit frustrating to end in a draw?
I think it's probably a fair reflection of a series that neither side really deserved to lose. I mean, it was fitting that the final match came down to the final day. England somehow got themselves back into a match which would have been their second most successful highest run chase in Test cricket ever in, you know, 200 years, the best part of, had they done it. And suddenly today they just needed 35 runs. India needed 4 wickets. We weren't sure whether it was going to be 3 or 4 that they needed, because Chris Wokes, as you mentioned, dislocated his shoulder. We weren't sure whether he was going to come out to bat. He did. He sort of hobbled out from the pavilion with his one arm strapped under his shirt, and in the end didn't have to face a ball, but he did have to run between the wickets to try and eat up the final few runs necessary for an England win. It wasn't to be in the end, but yeah, brave stuff.
Yeah, well, you say brave. I mean, there will be some people who just think that's just a bit too much from Chris Wokes. I mean, it was uncomfortable to see him. He was clearly still in a bit of pain, and just as a mum, I just think, go home and rest up, love.
Well,
it's a game.
Yeah. I think if it was the under 14 B team local friendly, as a parent, you might think maybe this one's not worth
it. My children played a much higher standard.
That wasn't about your children. That was about me. I played in the under 14 Bs. But yeah, you know, Joe Root was asked last night, will Chris Wokes come out and bat tomorrow if he's needed? And I don't think there was really a question from Chris Wokes or the England dressing room. He wanted to. They, you know, hoped that it wouldn't get to a situation where he was needed, but he was. And, you know, he did his best to run between the wickets. And in the end, it was Gus Atkinson who got bowled out. Chris Wokes wasn't the one who whose wicket fell to lose the match. But yeah, I mean, a 2-2 draw feels a fair reflection after the Test series that we've had. And now next up for England, they will travel to Australia for an Ashes series down under, which is probably the hardest thing to win in the sport.
Yeah, which will presumably, you hope, be as thrilling.
I hope so, yes. I mean, England haven't won an Ashes Test match in Australia since 2011, and they haven't won a series since then in Australia. It's an incredibly hard thing to do, so I think we're just hoping that it's close. You know, Australia are incredibly dominant at home. They are always one of the best cricket teams in the world. They may be going through a bit of a transitionary period at the moment. Maybe as were England, though, although in this series they've impressed. And yeah.
Yeah. But do you think that there is a little bit of magic in this squad that might change that long streak of not succeeding? I don't want to say failure.
It has been failure. That's fair. And before 2011, you know, you have to go back a long, long way for an England team to win an Ashes in Australia. But this team, it feels like there's something different about them. I mean, 300 for a Test second innings run chase was something that was basically unheard of. And now this England team under Brendan McCullum with Ben Stokes as their captain are doing it fairly regularly. 374, as I say, would have been their second highest ever Test run chase. And they looked like they were going to do it for a long time. It feels like there's a lot of discussion about whether playing baz ball is sensible, you know, just swinging for the fences all the time. And I think Bazball is effectively a device for relieving pressure on the players. If you're not afraid that your coach is going to give you the hairdryer treatment when you lose your wicket, getting out to trying to be ambitious at the crease, I think you are more likely to perform. And he's certainly got better performance out of the players. But when on Boxing Day there's over 90,000 Australians, you know, yelling abuse at you at the MCG, as there will be, that it's a very different prospect.
They're not going to win, in other words. Can I just ask a question about the one-handed wokes?
Yes.
Has anyone with only one arm ever scored runs for England in a test match?
You're testing... Cricket's been going for a very long time.
Yeah.
I don't know. Colin Cowdrey in 1963 at Lord's, it was the sort of obvious touch point to refer back to. He came out with a broken arm,
right.
and again, didn't face a ball. But it was a similar situation where he'd been injured earlier on in the match. You're not allowed substitutions in cricket. So basically, if Chris Wokes or Colin Cowdrey back in the day hadn't come out to bat, that would have been it. India would have only needed to take 9 wickets instead of 10.
Of Wokes' arms was available to him?
He dislocated his left. He is right-handed.
Oh, so he'd be all right.
So, exactly. Yeah, I don't know why everyone's making a big fuss about it.
Had a swing at it?
No, but...
Does it just look ridiculous? It's a very injured man on the pitch.
I mean, who knows how he would have approached it? Would he have sort of faced up left-handed so that his right arm was facing the bowler and the injured one was hidden? It's also a question of what India would have done, because they could have, you know, just basically bowled at his body and... It would have been quite an effective tactic, but quite horrible to watch. Anyway, I'm glad
didn't
it didn't
happen.
Come down to
it
that.
It didn't happen. Thank you. I mean, it's been great entertainment, this series, hasn't it?
It really has. It's great when, you know, cricket has a reputation, maybe unfairly, sometimes fairly, for not being the most captivating spectacle. And this series has you know, lit the front pages, the back pages rather, up. There's lots of sort of non-cricket fans talking about it and getting involved, and it's great for the sport.
We had some great images over the summer, haven't we? Chris Wokes, Hannah Hampton with the mini tampon up her nose. I mean, we'll never have another sporting summer like it, I don't think. It's been amazing.
There was a great one the other day where Ben Duckett lost his wicket to one of the Indian bowlers, who then sort of put his arm round him in quite a mocking, sarcastic way. I think Ben Duckett did quite well to not react to that. I think other cricketers wouldn't have fared so well.
May have done something.
Now, Paul is charging us with the following. I wonder whether you could possibly have a more sneering attitude towards the English cricket, England cricket. Very unedifying. Well, I don't think we're being sneering. We're just you're just pointing out the... Yes, and also the fact that when... they take on Australia in the Ashes, they're up against it because they haven't been doing very well for over a decade.
India are one of the best test sides in the world, as are England. It was a great series. You know, a draw is probably a fair result. And going to Australia for any team, whether it's India, whether it's New Zealand, whether it's England, South Africa, is an incredibly tough thing to do. And, you know, history suggests it will be very tough, but I think this team have the best chance since the 2011 team under Andrew Strauss won in Australia's backyard. And, you know, I'm optimistic, but maybe the evidence suggests that, you know, we should temper those hopes.
No, you keep your optimism. You're young and you'll need it. Thank you very much. That's Hugo Chambre. That takes us to,
well, just after 2:30, and next on Times Radio, could Donald Trump run a mile? I mean, let's face it, many of us hope he would, but it's probably unlikely that he would be able to run any distance at all. Why am I talking about this? We'll find out later. Let's get the latest news headlines. Tom Crowsdale.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thanks, Jane. Good afternoon. Trains have been cancelled, a bridge has been shut and homes are without power as Storm Floris sweeps in. An amber danger to life warning's in place until 10 p.m. across northern and central Scotland. While Edinburgh, northern England and Northern Ireland are covered by a yellow alert. It's led to the cancellation of the Royal Edinburgh Military Tattoos performance tonight. Jason Barrett is the event's chief executive.
When we met yesterday, all the factors were pointing to better to make the decision early in some ways for those that were coming to the show and traveling, that we would help them in their travels and prevent them from getting on the roads in some ways and again contribute to that safety.
Israeli forces are reportedly planning a new operation that would see them go into central Gaza and free the remaining hostages being held by Hamas. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says it's clear the group doesn't want a peace deal. Ministers are asking us to be patient with their efforts to tackle small boat channel crossings. They've announced an extra £100 million for it, with some of the cash going towards the one-in-one-out returns deal with France. It'd see someone who arrives here on a small boat sent back in exchange for an asylum seeker with a potential link to the UK. It's being called one of the most dramatic test match victories ever seen on British soil. India beat England by 6 runs at the Oval to draw the series, with Chris Wokes playing in a sling as the last English batsman. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
This is Times Radio.
Looking to grow your investments and generate a long-term income? The Scottish American Investment Company, also known as SAINTS, could help. SAINTS has been investing for over 150 years and focuses on growing capital as well as income by investing in a diverse range of companies from around the world. SAINTS is managed by Bailey Gifford, manager for some of the UK's best-known investment trusts. Find out key information and more at baileygifford.com. As with any investment, capital is at risk and income is not guaranteed.
Running a business can be expensive, which is why at NFU Mutual, we don't charge admin fees with our trades insurance, so you can easily make changes when you need to. No wonder 9 out of 10 of our business insurance customers renew every year. With agency offices across the UK, we're closer to you, closer to your business, closer to what matters. For quality trades insurance to suit all sizes, search NFU Mutual Builders and Trades Insurance.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Callum MacDonald for John Pienaar. All this week, all next week as well.
Correct.
A treat for everybody. Not that we don't love John, but a bit of Callum is no bad thing.
Thank you.
So 4 o'clock till seven, what have you got today?
Yeah, well, we've got lots, and what can only be described as the booking of the day. My dad will join us to talk right. about...
Difficult guest. Well done.
He drives a hard bargain, does Mr. MacDonald, and rightly so. He'll be talking, of course, about the weather. He is in the Western Isles, as listeners on Christmas Day to Times Radio will know. And so he'll tell us how bad
it's log fire on the go.
That's right, exactly. Yeah. It might even be on today. Who knows? We'll find out.
Summer in Scotland.
That's right, exactly.
If you turned to renewable energy sources, would you still go on Christmas Day?
Oh, yeah, certainly. We would just get the turbine up and running. The solar panels would be useless in that context, of course. Anyways, we're keeping an eye on the storm, of course. It's already having an impact, as you've just been hearing in the news, so we'll keep you up to date on that. One thing we'll be considering later in the programme is the announcement from Kate Forbes, who is the Deputy First Minister of Scotland, that she will not be seeking re-election as an MSP in the parliamentary elections in May next year, which is interesting in so many ways, but actually, even just at face value, what she said is that she wants to spend more time with her family. This is somebody who, a couple of years ago, was in the running to be the leader of the SNP and therefore become First Minister to succeed Nicola Sturgeon. She lost that contest to Humza Yousaf. Then last year, when John Swinney ended up replacing Humza Yousaf, it's largely considered that Kate Forbes sort of stood aside from challenging him, took the position of Deputy First Minister and Cabinet Secretary for Finance and the Economy, in order that the party would represent something of a unified force. The kind of team Swinney and Forbes would unite the party in their kind of under their different visions and in theory take the country with them. So I think there's an interesting question about Kate Forbes' departure, what it says about the SNP, and we'll broaden that out into how politicians, how they know when the time to go has come. How do they stand down? She could potentially have been First Minister.
Well, she's only 35. I mean, she could go away for a bit and then come back.
So I think this is the thinking, that maybe right. She goes away for maybe 2 election cycles, by which time her 3-year-old will obviously be a bit older, maybe life's a bit easier, in that regard, I mean. And that at that point, the party will have sort of... What does Doctor Who do? Reincarnated. You know, it'll have changed so much that it will actually be ready for somebody like Kate Forbes, which represents a slightly different type of politician to perhaps the more dominating voices of the SNP right now. So I think there's lots to consider about how you fit into a party and whether there's a question about how welcoming or unwelcoming that experience can actually be. So we'll discuss a bit of that. We've got a former Russian Prime Minister joining us today as well, which will be fascinating. How do you convince President Putin of anything? Do you ever argue with them? Do you fight with them? Do you challenge them? Do you say yes, sir, no, sir, and just walk away and hope for the best? We'll ask a former Russian Prime Minister. Also, the tactics of reform. This idea, so Reform UK, the political party, are holding a press conference, it would seem, every Monday of recess, which is actually a Tony Blair strategy. And commit some news, as we like to say, when the other politicians are on holiday. During recess, you can run things. So we'll be looking at the tactics and strategies of Reform UK and how effective they may or may not be over this recess period from Parliament as well.
Thank you very much, Callum.
You're welcome.
Callum McDonald, who's booked his dad for tonight's show on Times Radio between 4 o'clock and seven. Just very briefly, whereabouts on the Western Isles does he live? Because so people can picture it.
Yeah, exactly. The Isle of Lewis. So, okay. And a few miles out of Stornoway, the main town on the Isle of Lewis. So right. It's remote in the grand scheme of things. Although when you ask somebody there, when you say to somebody there, "Oh, it's very remote," and they'll say, "What from?"
Good point.
Which is a good point.
Yep.
So yes, they were expecting, this afternoon is when it's supposed to get bad there, so it could be kind of 80 miles per hour winds.
Well, I mean, that's, you want to be careful, don't you?
Yeah, it's dangerous.
Right, thank you very much. That's Callum a little bit later.
It's 22 minutes to three. Now, morning sickness can be a really, really horrible thing. In its extreme form, it's a condition called hyperemesis gravidarum, which means that mothers can't keep anything down, not food, not drinks, not even water, for some or all of their pregnancy. It can lead to the patient ending up in hospital, the Princess of Wales being one of the most high-profile women of late to suffer from it, although one in three women do suffer from this in their pregnancies. Now, only one drug is approved to treat it, but campaigners and an MP speaking to the Sunday Times say that doctors are often reluctant to prescribe it. Well, to try and answer the question as to why that might be, we've got Caroline Flint, who's the author of the book Sensitive Midwifery and the former president of the Royal College of Midwives, and also Charlotte Howden, chief executive of Pregnancy Sickness Support. A very good afternoon to both of you. Charlotte, I wonder if I could start with you. Can you just explain to people the symptoms of this condition and just how horrendous it can be for the mum?
Yeah, of course, and good afternoon. So hyperemesis gravidarum, as a condition, as a definition, is severe nausea and or vomiting in pregnancy. So it doesn't just have to be vomiting. That's often what gets the news lines, and there are women who are vomiting 30, 40, 50 times a day. I should know, I was one of them. But it's an incredibly extreme version of usual pregnancy sickness. And like you said, it affects between 1% to 3% of women every year. So at the top end, that's around 30,000. So this isn't niche and it's not rare, but it's definitely not as well known. Outside of that, it affects you from things like fatigue, being bedbound. Obviously, then you can't work. You're not able to look after your own children. Heightened sense of smell, and something called tylism, which is excessive saliva. So overall, it's absolutely horrific.
When you had it, did you fear for the safety and well-being of your baby? Because if you can't take on board enough liquid or nutrients, then you would be fearful for your pregnancy, wouldn't you?
Yeah, it's a really great question. And the reason for that is because this is really early pregnancy. So symptoms can start as early as 4 weeks pregnant. So especially if you're a first time mum, it's not that you haven't connected to that pregnancy yet, but you don't really know what pregnancy is like. So for me, ultimately later in the pregnancy, that became a fear. But in that initial kind of period and stages, I was completely convinced that I was going to die, because we all know that you can't survive without water. And that was something that I wasn't able to keep down any longer.
Right. What kind of treatment were you offered, did you find anything that was effective?
So initially, I wasn't offered any treatment. I was dismissed as just having usual morning sickness. Try opening a window. Have you tried ginger? The kind of old housewife tales that we get told. None of those worked, because this isn't usual. Eventually, I was admitted into hospital for fluids because I was so dehydrated, and was given anti-sickness medication in hospital, but that was then not prescribed to me once I was discharged from hospital, and so the vomiting and everything continued. Eventually, though, I saw an incredible consultant in hospital quite late into my first trimester, early into my second trimester, and I was finally prescribed medication, second-line treatments that were effective for me.
So what is this drug that you are trying to raise people's awareness about, and why might doctors be reluctant to prescribe it?
Yeah, it's a really interesting one. So Zomvia is currently the only medication that is licensed for use in pregnancy for nausea and vomiting in pregnancy. So it's licensed for use. However, that license became available in the UK in 2018. We're now at 2025. There's a huge education and knowledge gap on this drug. There are other medications that are used to treat NVP and hyperemesis. And this just doesn't seem to have made its way through to the front line of primary care. And there's also a really big issue with how it gets there in the first place, as England in particular is made up of ICBs, and each of those have their own formulary. And it's a complete postcode lottery, depending on where you live, as to whether you even have access to this medication.
Right. Just explain the acronyms for us. ICB.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. So ICB, so that's an integrated care board. So they effectively have the autonomy within a region to decide, you know, what medicines will be available on a formulary, which you can then prescribe from. It's quite a complex, I suppose, situation for new drugs coming in, because there's 42 of them and there isn't a blanket, oh, okay, we have a new drug, it's now available everywhere. You either have to apply to every single ICB to have that medication included, but GPs can also ask for it, hospitals can ask for it. But important, this is really quite crucial, I think, is that you can prescribe a medication off formulary. And I think this would be one of those examples where you can do that, where you have a patient who might not be responding to other treatments and you know there's another drug available, then you can make that prescription for that medication.
Stay where you are, Charlotte. Thank you for all of that. I want to bring in Carolyn Flint, who is former president of the Royal College of Midwives. And Karen, listening to all of that, let's start with the basics here. Do you still think that this is rather an underestimated condition for pregnant women?
Well, it is quite rare, but it does absolutely poleax women. I mean, it's absolutely dreadful. They feel like death warmed up. They can't stop vomiting. They feel nauseous. They can't keep down anything. I mean, literally nothing, no, not even water. So it's a terribly debilitating disease, I must say. And one is very, very sorry for any woman who has it. You asked Charlotte whether she was worried about her baby's safety. One of the things that midwives often say is it's because the mother is reacting so strongly to pregnancy and the hormones are so strong, the baby is likely to be very safe, which sounds ridiculous when you're not eating or drinking anything. But it's horrible, absolutely horrible.
Why isn't this drug that alleviates symptoms more widely available? I know you say that the HD, hyperemesis gravidarum, is quite rare, but actually morning sickness and the severe experience of morning sickness is incredibly common in pregnancy. So this should be a drug that's available to everybody, shouldn't it?
Well, should it? Should it? Hang on. When you think of all the mess-ups doctors have made with pregnancy and how dangerous and how cavalier their behaviour has been, you know, starting off with pelvic x-rays to see if your pelvis is big enough, which then, of course, ended up by showing that babies who had been x-rayed during that time were more likely to get childhood cancers. And of course thalidomide was a dreadful drug that harmed and incapacitated and disabled lots and lots and lots of children.
But
for morning sickness
But Caroline, shouldn't we be a little bit careful about that? Because, of course, the thalidomide scandal was absolutely appalling. But would it not be logical to think that there is a shadow hanging over subsequent drugs to alleviate morning sickness, where, in fact, that might be unfair? I mean, I assume that this new drug, Zomvia, has gone through all of the right trials. Charlotte, you might be able to help us out with that part of this.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, with the greatest respect for Caroline and her position, the way she's speaking is incredibly dangerous, because Zomvia is licensed for use in pregnancy. It could not have a license for use in pregnancy if it was going to have any negative effect on the fetus. And I would also argue that thalidomide was 70 years ago. And I know we talk about women's health not being quite as far forward as we would like it to be, and certainly in terms of funding and research. But 70 years ago was a long time in the healthcare service. And we know now that what can happen when you take medications and it crosses the placenta. We didn't know that at that time. So I can speak now to anyone who might be taking medication for pregnancy sickness or HG and say the drugs that you would have been prescribed are safe to use. They would not be on the guidelines if they weren't. So please do not be concerned about that.
Okay. Caroline, can we just turn to you, though, for an explanation of this kind of a postcode lottery of care in pregnancy? And that's something that isn't only to do with drugs. There have been so many parts of the country where it has been really horrendously proven over the last 10 years it's been a dangerous thing to have a baby. How do you assess the national state of maternity care at the moment?
Well, it's interesting you should say that it's been shown to be dangerous to have a baby. It's been shown to be dangerous to have a baby in hospital. I mean, hospitals are necessary for any women who are ill, any pregnancies that need help, any labours that need assistance. Of course they do. But do be aware that there is copious research to show that when women book for a home birth, they have less complications, they need less pain relief, they have less cesareans, they have less scars, they have 75% less chance of an infection. And that was all in The Lancet, for goodness sakes, a very highly respected medical journal.
Sure. We're almost out of time. I just want to give the last word to Charlotte. I know that you now have an MP, Liberal Democrat MP for Lewis in East Sussex, who is going to try and take the cause of this dreadful morning sickness forward in a way that can be helpful to patients suffering from it. His wife suffered from it. What else should people do? And there'll be people listening this afternoon who are experiencing it, or they know somebody who is. And sometimes we take a lot on ourselves, don't we, Charlotte, as women, and think, yep, I'm throwing up 20 times a day. This is pregnancy. I'll just kind of carry on. And we shouldn't feel like that, should we? We need to do things.
Absolutely. If you think about how our economy is, you know, women make up, what is it, more than 50% now? We're half of the population of this country. Not all, of course, will be pregnant, but we contribute so much to this country. And so to effectively take us out of operation because, you know, healthcare professionals might not be empowered to prescribe or there isn't enough information out there is just not good enough. So if you are feeling horrendous and you're worried about going due to pregnancy sickness, you probably won't know that you have HG. Please make that first step. Go and see your GP, go and see your doctor. It's a bit later on in your pregnancy, your midwife. Obviously, I'm going to say reach out to pregnancy sickness support. We can advocate on your behalf and have all the evidence-based information to support you in making decisions about taking medication and next steps for treatment. But you're not alone. There's thousands of women who go through this every year, and hopefully we can help you.
Very good to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. That's Charlotte Howden, who's Chief Executive of Pregnancy Sickness Support. A good place to start if you do need some answers. And Caroline Flint joined us too, the author of Sensitive Midwifery and former President of the Royal College of Midwives.
9:03. And some sad news just in. Our colleague over at Talk, James Whale, has died at the age of 74. He was first diagnosed with kidney cancer in 2000 and found out 5 years ago that the cancer had come back and spread to his brain, lungs and spine. We're going to go to the States next. It's Times Radio.
Early breakfast on Times Radio with Elavon. As a new day dawns, join Rosie Wright as she connects you with the latest breaking news and provides intelligent opinion on all the morning headlines.
Plus, get ahead of all the markets with updates, analysis and insight with my daily dedicated business bulletin.
Early breakfast with Rosie Wright. Every Monday to Friday morning from 5 on Times Radio with Elavon. Your world of payments. Find out more at elavon.co.uk.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
What time is it?
8 a.m.
And I've already meditated, stretched, and been for a big run.
How?
It's my new Samsung Galaxy Watch 8 Classic. It's got sleep tracking and bedtime guidance to remind me when to go to bed. So I always wake up early and fresh.
And you made me coffee.
That's mine.
Oh.
Buy the new Galaxy Watch 8 Classic today at Samsung.com. Requires smartphone on Android 11 or above with the latest version of the Samsung Health app. Intended for general wellness and fitness purposes only.
Wow, Direct Line sorted my claim with a 5-year guarantee on the car repairs. That's how it's done. Imagine if that's how everything got done. Like getting my kids to eat their greens.
Mummy, the vegetable van is here. Please can I have a broccoli pop? Or a courgette? Please?
Go on then.
Direct Line. That's how it's done.
Valid whilst the car is yours. Must use approved repairers. Excludes poor maintenance, later damage, wear and tear.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
American school children are going to see a change in their PE education, their physical fitness, as Donald Trump has signed an executive order last Thursday, reinstating something I confess I didn't know it ever existed, the presidential fitness test. So let's take a listen to what President Trump announced last week. Here he is speaking at the White House.
We're officially restoring the presidential fitness test and the presidential fitness award, and it's going to be a very big thing. From the late 1950s until the 2013, graduate scholars all across our country competed against each other in the presidential fitness test. And it was a big deal. This was a wonderful tradition, and we're bringing it back.
The president is also re-establishing the President's Council on Sports, Fitness and Nutrition, and it will be overseen by his health secretary, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Daniel Lipman is the White House and Washington reporter for Politico. Daniel, the irony here is pretty obvious, but let's investigate it anyway. Donald Trump doesn't look all that fit to me, reinstating this presidential fitness test. Has it all been mocked, or are people celebrating this?
I think there's a wide range of opinions on this. People are joking. Are they going to include golf on this fitness test, given that Trump every weekend is hitting the one of his golf courses? And so how important is that to someone's fitness? One can judge. And so I think there are some people who are saying, hey, this is important to do because a lot of young people are addicted to their phones, addicted to Instagram. They don't get out of the house that much. The rates of obesity among kids is astronomical. And so they're Trump is trying to encourage people to stay healthy, even if he himself is not always in the best of shape. And others are saying this is a kind of going to be a Hunger Games type competition, and people are going to get embarrassed and shamed if they don't meet the fitness standards.
Now, as I understand it, it was withdrawn under President Obama because there were concerns about body shaming. Is that correct?
I think that was part of it, that Obama and that era in America was much more about body positivity. And the pendulum has definitely swung back where people and culture is much more about being thin. And we've seen the rise of Ozempic in terms of millions of Americans using that drug to lose a lot of weight. And the pendulum has definitely shifted where especially among conservatives, this type of body ideal of being very fit, eating healthy, the Make America Healthy Again movement, and being thin, that is really popular on the right. And I think Trump is responding to that in some ways with this re-edition of the fitness test.
Well, Daniel, you're a young man. Did you have to take part in this test when you were at school?
Well, I went to private school, and so they didn't really apply to private schools. And so public schools, they had to do that much more. And so this is the government can't mandate private schools to do much of anything. And Trump himself went to a military academy in New York. So I don't think he actually participated in this test, although they did, I'm sure, have lots of exercises. I was the type of person who, when we had our running in high school for my tennis team, I would hang back in the back, hide behind the trees, and then as people ran up the Hill, I would rejoin them and pretend that I had taken part in the full run. So I may not be the best analyst on this topic, I guess.
Well, you've been very honest and we appreciate it. Now, as I understand it, the test consists of push-ups, sit-ups, a shuttle run, a one-mile run, and something called the V-seat reach, which is where you have to sit with your legs extended to a V-shape and then you stretch forward and try to determine how far you can get your fingertips, how far you can stretch your whole arms and fingers out. I can't believe that anybody would enjoy doing it, but presumably it will sort the wood from the trees, the wheat from the chaff. What am I trying to say? Determine who's fit and who isn't.
Yeah, I think this is almost like where they put people's grades on the bulletin board, and then people can see who is doing very well in school and who's not. But especially with people's bodies, there are a lot of mental health issues that young people face, anxiety, people looking at the state of the world and not being that optimistic, especially among Generation Z and the next generation coming up. And so you want to, of course, have kids be very fit. And it would be good for society overall if everyone was hitting the gym every other day, and it would reduce healthcare costs tremendously, I'm sure, because obesity is one of the driving factors of the record amount of money that the U.S. spends on health. But you also don't want to make kids feel bad about not being in shape, that there's ways to encourage.
Well, no, exactly. The whole body shaming thing hasn't gone away, is it? Some poor kids are going to be worried sick about taking this test.
And you don't want to introduce people to get eating disorders, especially young girls. And you don't want to turn people off exercise unnecessarily for their whole lives if they have bad memories from this test. And so there are going to be, I'm sure, kids who like getting something in the mail from the White House saying that they've won the Presidential Fitness Award if they're in the top cohort of people who are fit. They can put that on their wall and feel like that they were, very in shape, and their parents can feel good about that. But there's definitely a balance to be struck in terms of not turning off kids from the benefits of exercise.
Daniel Lipman, thank you very much. Astonishingly, two listeners have WhatsApped to say they think Donald Trump does look fit.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Well, it is very true. I couldn't do what he's doing at the age of 79, but the world wouldn't want me to. Jane and I are going to be doing the V-check during the news bulletin. We'll get back to you and let you know our stats. It is now 3 o'clock. In the next hour, YouTubing your way through border control, we look at the world of immigration influencers. Storm Floris is more than brewing. The very latest on that from Scotland. Books for the summer and are you owed car finance refunds? Adam Shaw has all of the answers at a quarter to four. All of that happens after the news from Tom Crowsdale.
Thanks, Vicky. Good afternoon. A danger to life warning's in place for millions of people across Scotland, where Storm Floris has brought gusts of more than 100 miles per hour. An alert's also in place in the northern half of the UK, where the Tyne Bridge has been closed in East Lothian. Passengers on LNER and Avanti West Coast are being told to avoid certain journeys, while flights at Glasgow Airport have also been affected. In the Republic of Ireland, 10,000 homes and businesses have lost power. Angela Knight is the former CEO of Energy UK. She's told Times Radio there have been examples in recent times of supplies not being restored quickly enough.
We have had some pretty poor performances where people have been out for far too long. And that has been something of a wake-up call to both your power suppliers and the network providers and so on. The reality is that they have got a responsibility to get to you quickly.
Israel's understood to be planning a new military operation to free its remaining hostages in Gaza. The IDF has previously avoided going into parts of the strip where it's thought people are being held in case it puts them in danger. But Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says it's clear Hamas doesn't want a deal to release them. The Home Secretary says she's set the foundation for a new and stronger approach to tackling small boat crossings. Yvette Cooper's giving £100 million of extra funding for efforts to crack down on them, including 300 more National Crime Agency officers. The Times Home Affairs editor Matt Dathan's been asked how the government is performing.
If you judge it by the raw numbers, not very well at all. The number of crossings are up 50%. But Starmer and Yvette Cooper and Home Office officials have insisted that it will take time for the extra investment, not only in the equipment, the undercover surveillance equipment, etc., but also the personnel, will take time to come through in terms of reducing the number of crossings.
We're just hearing veteran broadcaster James Whale has died at the age of 74 after a long battle with cancer. James's career started back in the 70s and he's credited with pioneering the late night shock jock phone-in in the UK. It ended up being broadcast on TV. Up until recently, James had a regular show on our sister station Talk. England's series with India has ended in a 2-2 draw, with the visitors winning the final match by 6 runs at the Oval. England needed 35 runs to win on the last day, but lost 4 wickets in the first hour. Chris Wokes was the last batter, but had his arm in a sling, as he has a shoulder problem. The Times' Charlie Tolbert-Smith was watching.
Unbelievable fight back from India to win, and that is the end of the series. It's drawn 2-2. Impartially speaking, you'd have to say it's probably a fair reflection of the summer. 3-1 would have flattered England. India have more than played their part in an extraordinary 5-test series.
And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Well, look, the good news is Jane and I have passed our V test, haven't we? We've tried that out in the studio, so we might get part of a certificate from the President of the United States. But we agree that we couldn't run a mile. What else was in there?
Sit-ups, push-ups. I don't know how many. And the shuttle run. Now, that's quite hard to do. You know, when you run through, you run between various points, and I think you have to do it quicker and quicker over a certain amount of time, and that can be really punishing. I could have got that wrong. So that's something that I think schools quite often do as a way of assessing pupils' fitness in this country. But they're quite hard.
Yep. I'm surprised that we weren't put through our literal physical paces before we joined Times Radio. It's that kind of station, isn't it?
Imagine physical.
If we had to go through physical.
I know what that would... Well, I'm not going
no,
there.
No radio station would have any presenters on air were that to be the case. Thank you for some extraordinary messages and texts, actually, this afternoon about the experience of a very severe hyperemesis gravidarum, which is the most extreme form of morning sickness. This comes from Sue, who says, 40 years ago, I was pregnant with my third child. I used to have the most horrendous sickness. It was 24 hours a day for the first few months. My marriage was rocky and I couldn't face the pregnancy, so I had a termination to my eternal regret. My marriage wasn't salvageable in the end, but had the pregnancy been easier, I would have continued with it. What a thing to regret. And we were so sorry to read that, actually, but I think it does really help to clarify the mind as to the experience of women who are physically incredibly unwell during pregnancy. The knowledge that you've got another, you know, 9 months of something that is making you so unwell at the beginning is just incredibly difficult. Mm. And that's why, you know, we've been talking about it today. That's why, you know, an MP has got involved to try and highlight an issue which is not just morning sickness. And also morning sickness is a daft term because in our experience and the experience of nearly everybody I know who's ever been pregnant, it's not just in the morning. This one comes in from Yolanda, who says, during the delivery of my son, I was high on gas, everything distorted, including my baby. All I remember is the midwife plonking my son on my breast and me thinking I'd given birth to ET. Christine says, I was disturbed by the former head of midwives using statistics to say that home births were safer than hospital births. That's because the most complicated cases end up in hospital. Therefore, there would be more risks with the cases that are in hospital. By definition, it's like saying that more people die in hospital than at home. That's because the sicker people go to hospital.
That's a good point. And just to lighten things up, Matthew says, those saying Trump looks fit have got their vowels mixed up.
It's okay.
I think I'm with you.
Let's talk about something completely different at 3:06. There are YouTube videos online garnering tens of thousands of views that are coaching potential migrants how to use charity visas to bring their families to the UK. Kelvin Asai is one of those YouTubers, a man who describes himself as a relocation content creator.
Do you know you can actually come to the UK via the charity worker visa, and you can then bring your dependents to come and stay with you? And the good catch here is that while you're working in a voluntary job and you're getting stipends, your dependent has unlimited hours to work. So they can actually get a full-time job and, you know, support the family. And if they get a visa, if they get the tier 2 visa, you move with them and you become their dependent. So this whole thing I'm going to explain today, I'm going to explain how you should search for charity worker and jobs and sponsors in the UK, and then use that as a leverage to bring in your family into the UK.
Well, that is Kelvin Asai. Let's talk to Joey Durso, senior data journalist for The Times and Sunday Times, who wrote a fantastic article that you can read available on the app about all of these ways of immigration advice being delivered. Joey, just talk us through what the legal route is here that Mr. Asai is referring to.
Yeah, so it's a charity visa. It's a perfectly legal route. I mean, the idea is a pretty, you know, a noble one, which is that people from other countries can come to the UK to volunteer for a year or so. But it's pretty clear from these videos that it's being used as a backdoor long-term migration route for people to bring in dependents, for people to bring in their families. You're not allowed to be paid a formal salary by a charity. It's a volunteer visa, but there's lots of talk of stipends and a way of getting around those rules. And you can actually bring in a spouse who can do paid work. So, yeah, it's these kind of elaborate mechanisms of getting around the kind of increasingly strict visa rules through a charity visa, which is intended for people who want to come and work for a charity. But it's clearly being used for something quite different here.
Why would this country need people to come from abroad to work for charities? Is that something that is proving difficult to fill?
Oh, that's a very good question. I mean, there's lots of great charities in this country that are, you know, understaffed, under-resourced, and could do with people to volunteer. You know, I think it's maybe quite a good question why they need people from abroad. But, you know, I suppose it's labour, isn't it? It's work, people who want to do difficult, important work. And if that is completely just what people want to come to this country to do, I think there's no problem with that. But it does seem a pretty big problem to me when people are using it just to enter the country for the long term, potentially with no real interest in the charity at all.
Sure. And I mean, what's very telling about the instructions that we heard in that YouTube video is there is very little being said about the actual volunteer work that would be involved in a charity visa. It is all about the other people who might be able to come with you, how long they could stay, what they would then be able to do. It's skewed, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. And a lot of these organisations are kind of quite small churches, religious organisations, not necessarily the big charities you might have heard of, you might instantly associate with voluntary work. Some of these are quite obscure organisations, which, yeah, looks a bit like a backdoor to long-term migration. Which there's
How many people have watched that particular video?
It's tens of thousands last time we looked at it, so not huge numbers, but we know that these numbers of charity visas are going up quite a lot. It was 1,000 a few years ago. I think it's gone up to about 2,500. I think one thing we know about migration is that increasingly, you know, the more and more people want to come to the UK, the government's trying to reduce numbers and close down various routes. And if a route looks like it's a way that people can come, numbers can increase really quickly. And in the age of social media, we saw things with this case on YouTube and on TikTok. Things can spread very quickly, and if it looks like there's a loophole, this can spread like wildfire, and a small number of applicants can become a very large one very quickly.
And this isn't the only example that is described in the article in The Times of immigration advice that is being delivered on YouTube. Can you tell us a bit more about how other people are being advised to come to the UK?
Yeah, so there's quite a few of these around this charity visa. We found sort of three or four different people. And yeah, the common themes were this stipend, which is quite vaguely defined. I mean, you can't earn a salary paid into your bank account, PAYE, as a salary is usually known, but you can get a stipend for accommodation, for transport, for housing. And yeah, that's very vaguely defined. So it's clearly a sort of shadow salary, the way these people talk about it. And also the issue of dependence and bringing in a family and bringing in a spouse who is allowed to work. So yeah, basically this thing that is intended for, you know, lone charity workers to come over and do good work for a defined period of time is clearly being used by people to bring their family over to live in the UK for the long term, which is not what it was designed for.
Do you know whether or not the government is looking at exactly these kind of cases and regarding them to be a loophole?
Well, we didn't get much of a comment from the government when we approached them. I don't know if they knew about it, to be honest. There wasn't a clear suggestion that this was something they were looking into.
And what about the way that these immigration advisors, I think Mr. Asai describes himself as a relocation content creator, which is a new one on me. But is there any suggestion that these immigration advisors are actually breaking any kind of law? Would there be any recourse the government could take to stop them doing what they're doing?
I don't think so. I mean, I think these people have found a loophole, basically, and they're quite careful in how they word it. And a couple of us, them gave statements to us in which they were quite careful in how they worded it. You know, this is allowed in the letter of the law. It's a stipend, not a salary. You can bring in a dependent, a spouse who can work. You know, no one is saying you can come and work for a charity as a salary. These people are very careful with their language. And I think, you know, there are large parts of the world and people really want to come to the UK, to Europe, where salaries are higher and for all sorts of reasons. And from these people's perspective, you know, they've found a way to legally do it. I wouldn't be necessarily saying that they're terrible people or anything like that at all. I mean, they've just found a loophole which the British government might not have known about.
Sure. And it's absolutely the right point to make. I mean, especially because we're talking about charity work here. There must be a lot of people who've come into this country truly believing in the work that they're doing for churches or charities or whatever it is. The way it's being sold, I think, definitely raises some eyebrows on the YouTube. Thank you very much indeed. Senior data journalist for The Times and Sunday Times. That's Joey Durso.
Now, I've got to say, you're on good form this afternoon. Keech says, ladies, imagine that Donald Trump is standing beside you, then see if you can run a mile. Sorry. Right, okay, we must move on. It's Times Radio, and Scotland's Deputy First Minister Kate Forbes is going to stand down at next year's Holyrood elections. She made her decision known in a letter to the First Minister John Swinney and is expected to stay in her role until those Scottish Parliament elections in May of 2026. Let's go to Scotland and Katrina Stewart, who's a political correspondent. Was this expected, Katrina?
It wasn't expected. There has been real surprise today at this announcement. Kate Forbes is a prominent figure in the SNP. She is well respected and she had been approved for standing again for the Holyrood election next year. So this has really come out of the blue in the middle of recess, and it leaves big questions about what John Swinney is going to do next, what's next for the SNP, and whether the reasons that she's given are on the surface of it, the real reasons, or whether there is something else going on behind the scenes.
People are always a bit cynical about this sort of thing, aren't they? But shall we take her at face value? She has a daughter of three. She's in her mid-30s. She might quite reasonably think that this is the time to devote her time to her young family.
And she has devoted herself to the SNP. She has stepped in and stepped up repeatedly at times of crisis. She became a government minister in 2018 when the finance secretary had to step down on the eve of the Scottish budget. She was handed this brief and she performed very well and she impressed people at that point. She then, when Nicola Sturgeon stepped down very suddenly as first minister in 2023, ran in the leadership race. She more recently was planning to run to be First Minister, to be leader of the SNP against John Swinney. But after conversations behind the scenes, she decided not to do that, not to put herself up against him and to be Deputy First Minister. So I don't think anyone could say that she hasn't been devoted enough to the party. But she also lives in a rural constituency. It's a grueling commute from her part of Scotland into Holyrood. Naomi, her daughter, is just turning three. And she has written extensively. She has talked extensively about the issues around childcare. She's having to take Naomi around with her, ask people to step in and look after her daughter at the last minute. And she just wants, she's 35, she wants to be there for her young family.
Yeah, I mean, I think there'll be so many people who can absolutely understand that and will have been through similar experiences themselves. So where does this leave the SNP? Who are the natural successors to John Swinney now?
It looks like it's going to be a competition between Stephen Flynn, who's currently an MP, and Mary McCallan, who is the housing secretary. Mary McCallan is seen very much as Kate Forbes was as well, as being a rising star. Stephen Flynn has his eye on Holyrood and very much is ambitious and has spoken of that ambition. So I think it's going to be head to head between the two of them, though John Swinney will very much be leading the party into the Holyrood election. He has said that he is sticking around, but it's going to be very interesting seeing what the shape of the SNP looks like, because they are losing some of their biggest names. We've had quite a number of high-profile SNP MSPs say that they're not going to be standing, which includes Hamza Youssef, former First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, Shona Robison, Eleanor Whittam. So there are huge challenges ahead for John Swinney building up a portfolio of as significant names and people who are seen as credible to help with the party.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. Looking at the reaction to the resignation or the announcement today from Kate Forbes, a one Tory MSP, a woman called Liz Smith, has said, "I'm very sorry to read this. The Scottish Parliament needs the Kate Forbes of this world." And then from Labour, the MSP Jackie Bailey, "Kate Forbes was the future once. Ouch. But she can see the writing on the wall." What are the polls saying about the Holyrood elections?
It's going to be a challenge for the SNP. They are still coming out in front, but they are far away from where they were at the 2021 elections. So there is a deal of work to be done there. They also have the added headache of Reform UK, and you've seen John Swinney over the past few months trying to work out exactly how he's going to meet that challenge head on. Scottish Labour have had their ups and downs. They are really struggling in the polls with regards to decisions that are being taken at Westminster, but they've had a few by-election successes recently, so all is not lost for Scottish Labour. So it is going to be a very interesting challenge and an interesting run-up to Holyrood 2026.
Really appreciate your time. Thank you, Katrina. Katrina Stewart, a Scotland a political correspondent, and just to mark your card, Nicola Sturgeon, she was mentioned in that conversation. She has got a book out. It's coming out next week, and she will be on our programme at some point next week.
Something to look forward to.
Oh, yes.
Yes. We will pay our tribute to James Whale in a couple of moments' time. But let's talk about the weather first, because Storm Floris has been battering the UK with amber and yellow warnings in force across the country. There have been reports of wind gusts reaching between 80 and 100 miles per hour. Trains have been cancelled. Motorists are warned to reconsider their journeys. Let's talk to Jim Dale, senior meteorologist at British Weather Services. Jim, just talk us through where the amber alerts are across the UK, please.
OK, they are essentially across Scotland. So I know you've just been doing a political spot there, but Scotland seems to be getting its independence in a very different way, perhaps one that they don't really want at this time of year, to say the least. So amber across Scotland, yellow further south, Northern Ireland, Northern England, and these are still in force and will be for the rest of the day, more or less, to the end, and a little bit of North Wales in there as well. So that's the demarcation lines. And at the moment, Floris, Super Floris, is over the Orkney Islands. For those who reckon these things, 978 millibars as we speak. And you mentioned some wind speeds there, 109 miles an hour at Cairnwell, which is actually a mountain resort, so I'm not sure it actually counts, because if we go back in history, 87 miles an hour is the August highest gust ever, and that was in 1996 on the Needles, Isle of Wight. At the moment, 80 has been registered at South East. I think that's the Western Isles, out on the west there. So an exposed site, they always are who get these records, and that's about where we are at the moment.
Is Storm Floris going to be worse than other recent storms, or are the warnings getting better?
Bit of both, really. You know, no storms are ever the same. They hit different areas, they do different things. They, you know, whether we're talking damage or sadly casualties, we will see by the end of it. The last one that we had in August was Storm Lillian, only last year on the 22nd of August. So this, although I would say that they are unusual, August storms, but in the last, since 2020, we've actually seen five of them. So they're not that unusual. So, you know, from time to time, they do roll in. And this is the time of year when you get the warmer seas providing the energy. I mean, there's three types of storm that we get at this time of year. This one, what you might call a natural jet stream type storm. Then we've got ex-hurricanes that occasionally turn up on our doorstep. And then we've got the other one that comes up from the south, which is heat-borne, heat-generated. That was what did in for Boscastle in 2004 with the thunderstorms, etc. Put a lot of rain down rather than necessarily the wind. But this is the time of year where we start to have to look over our shoulder for events such as this one.
How long will Storm Floris last?
To the end of the day and a little bit into the overnight period as far as northeast Scotland is concerned. We've still got a good 10 hours to go in terms of the meat of this. But as I say, it's over Orkney at the moment and it will continue to drift into the North Sea. So the backside, yes, has still got some venom. So people have to be aware that those that have decided to stay in, that it might be the best option to continue to stay in and maybe, you know, come again another day.
Sure. There's been some extraordinary weather across the world recently. And at the moment, there is snow in Australia, isn't there?
Yeah, look, every single day the doorbell rings as far as weird and, I say wonderful, weird and catastrophic events, mostly. Mostly heat generated, but this isn't. In Australia, Queensland, North South Wales, last few days, snow, which is extremely unusual, actually, for that part of the world, even in a winter scenario. I mean, certainly South Queensland, this is a subtropical area, suddenly went very cold. Obviously, the air mass from that came from the South Pole, the south direction rather than the north in the southern hemisphere. So, yeah, it blanketed and it wasn't just a couple of inches. It in certain places, it was a couple of feet. So stranded cars and things like this. We live in a really weird time at this moment in time in terms of what's going on around the world. Yes, and a lot of this would be climate change driven. I don't want to lose that fact that some of these excesses create what we might call chaotic and also big weather. And, you know, we're having to pick up the pieces. I know we don't necessarily look on that in the United Kingdom and say, oh, you know, look over there, what's going on? 52 degrees in Iran, for example, or wildfires in Turkey. They've really got to catch the sort of news headlines to get anywhere. But in my job, I see these every single day. And I can tell you, it's like counting, it's like putting the dots together on a map and trying to draw a picture. And the picture is very, very clear.
Sure.
Getting worse, not better.
Jim, thank you very much. Jim Dale, Senior Meteorologist at British Weather Services. Callum will update you in his programme after 4 o'clock. He's got a man on the ground on the Isle of Lewis. It's his dad, and there is no better person to inform us about the path of Storm Floris.
Well, his dad's got a fan. Christina said she can't wait to hear those dulcet Isle of Lewis tones again. It's normally a Christmas morning treat for her, but she's going to have a midsummer treat of Mr. Callum MacDonald's dad on the Drive Time show today. Christine, brace yourself. He's incoming. Now, sad news this afternoon that our talk colleague James Whale has died at the age of 74. Here is Mike Graham's tribute to him.
James began his remarkable career in the early 1970s when he pioneered a new kind of radio in Britain, the late-night shock jock phone-in. By the late 1980s, the James Whale radio show had become a cultural phenomenon, broadcasting every weekend on ITV. He attracted millions of viewers, making him a household name.
Ladies and gentlemen, please enjoy the Saw Doctors!
James would go on to host a variety of programmes for ITV, Sky and the BBC before finding a new audience with talk radio, all the while continuing to make headlines during his appearance on Celebrity Big Brother. In 2006, after surviving kidney cancer, James launched Kidney Cancer UK, raising hundreds of thousands of pounds.
The problems with all cancers is nobody bothers to get checked. And if you get checked early, then you will actually have a much better outcome. But people don't do that.
In 2024, James was awarded an MBE in the New Year Honours, recognising his extraordinary contribution to broadcast and charity.
If I have a few more months, that will be great. If I have until next Christmas or this coming Christmas will be nice, wouldn't it? But if I die tomorrow, I've had an amazing time and I married an amazing lady.
James Whale broke the rules, he shaped the airwaves and did it all on his own terms. For millions, James wasn't just a broadcaster. He was a companion, a provocateur and a good friend that we'll all never forget. God bless you, James. We'll miss you.
That's Mike Graham. Well, in his last interview, James Whale spoke to Reform UK leader and longtime friend Nigel Farage at his home in Kent as he looked back on his career and the world of politics.
Thanks, Nigel.
James, you're a complete star.
I hope I've got more than a few weeks, but...
Well, so do I.
That's really made me...
So do I. And you never know, miracles do happen.
They do. They do.
They do happen. Well, your career's been a miracle. Yeah.
Well, it has, considering I had no A-levels, O-levels... CSEs, or even a letter after my name for broadcasting.
You said to me the other day, you've never really had a job.
I haven't.
Well, that interview is available on Talk's YouTube channel. And just a couple of days ago, James Whale recorded a podcast from his hospice bed.
I probably won't be here next week, but I'm fine. I've got so many drugs in me, I can't feel a thing. So it's exactly true, but, you know.
Well, that's James Whale, who has died very sadly at the age of 74. So our very best wishes to his friends and family, who are obviously very much missing him.
And he was a real pioneer of speech radio, where people could say what they wanted to say.
Yeah, absolutely, he was there at the start, wasn't
he? We take it for granted now that... what we want to encourage is authenticity on the airwaves. We want to provide an opportunity for people to have a bit of a ding-dong. But I think if you cast your mind back to 20 years ago, radio just wasn't like that. Radio was formal. It was deferential. If you did a phone-in, you know, people were still being introduced as his Mr. Gerard has joined us on the Jimmy Young Show or whatever it was. And James Whale just always did it differently. He always, right from the get-go, had a very different tone about him. And I think he just wanted radio to become more what it has become. So in his career and in his lifetime, I think... we became more James Whale than James Whale could ever have anticipated.
Also, very, very brave of him to talk about being ill, to talk when he was ill, just to own it in a way. Because, I mean, neither you nor I are very ill. We're very fortunate. But it takes tremendous courage to do that. And I truly think that is, it's a pioneering thing to do, actually, in many ways.
So, it is, yeah.
Impressive.
And also, it's not to say that he didn't cause offence, because he did massively.
He also did that.
Massively cause offence.
Let's also say that, yes.
Yeah, well, but you don't want to be hagiographic when somebody dies. And that was kind of his calling card as well, wasn't it? So I think he'd want to be remembered as somebody who really could poke things around a bit.
The last thing he'd want to be remembered as is some kind of anodyne person who just kept the needles going.
Yes.
That was not the late, great James Whale.
He was never considered for poetry, please. Coming up, we'll get the latest top book recommendations with Laura Hackett, Deputy Literary Editor at The Times and Sunday Times. Let's get a check on the latest news headlines first. It's just gone 3:30. Here's Tom Crosdell.
Carol Walker on Times Radio.
600 former Israeli security officials are calling on President Trump to do more to end the war in Gaza. We'll assess the growing international pressure on the Israeli government. We'll have the latest on the political battle here over immigration. And more than 50 private schools have closed down since Labour imposed VAT on their fees. We'll discuss the effect on pupils, parents and our education system.
Carol Walker, tonight from 10 on Times Radio. Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Ministers in Scotland say it's imperative people follow advice as Storm Floris brings unseasonably strong winds. The northern half of the UK is under a yellow weather warning for wind, meaning travel disruptions expected, while there could be damage to buildings. A more serious amber one is in place for northern Scotland, where some train lines are closed. Several operators are telling people not to travel, while 10,000 homes and businesses in the Republic of Ireland don't have power. Forecaster Gemma Plum's told Times Radio what's going on.
For some areas,
areas, we could see wind gusts of 80 to 90 miles an hour for some exposed coast hills and bridges. And there's bridges that have been closed already. Events have been cancelled. There's been flights cancelled as well. So it is going to bring some big impacts, this storm.
Israel's prime minister says it's clear Hamas doesn't want a peace deal in Gaza that would secure the release of hostages the group is still holding. The IDF is understood to be planning a new military operation to go in and get them. TV and radio presenter James Whale has died at the age of 74. He had stage 4 kidney cancer. James's career started at Metro Radio in 1974, where he pioneered the late-night radio phone-in. More recently, he was at our sister station, Talk. England's test series with India has ended in a 2-2 draw, with the visitors winning the final match by 6 runs at the Oval. England needed 35 runs to win on the last day, but lost 4 wickets in the first hour. For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
This is Times Radio. Direct Line's flexible business cover means I only pay for the cover I need. That's how it's done. Imagine if that's how everything got done. Like dominating the pub quiz.
Final question. What is the population of Mongolia?
3,537,947.
It's absolutely correct. This week's winner is none of your quizness.
Direct Line. That's how it's done.
Underwritten by UK Insurance Limited.
Introducing McDonald's side missions. Every weekday, a new exclusive mission will drop in the app, like a $1.99 Big Mac with
the Big Mac of Destiny side mission,
and a chance to win prizes every weekend. Only on the McDonald's app. 18 plus app only. Ends 10th of August. One play per day. Fees apply to delivery. Participation varies. Serving times and T's and C's apply.
How are you looking so fresh?
It's my new Samsung Galaxy Watch 8. It's got this thing called Running Coach, which creates custom training plans just for me. Oh, and that's our cue to pick up the pace.
What? This isn't fast enough. Oh.
Smash your fitness goals with a new Galaxy Watch 8. Buy today at Samsung.com. Requires smartphone on Android 11 or above with the latest version of the Samsung Health app.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
At car loans, car finance, are you due compensation? If you are due it, how do you get hold of it? I mean, everyone's got a car loan, haven't they?
No, I don't think
really?
So.
Really? Who hasn't, if they've got a car?
Some people buy it outright.
Really?
Yes, I believe so.
Right.
But there are so many questions we need to ask Adam Shaw about how to get the refund if we're owed the refund. So he's in about 10 minutes' time.
Right. So that's our personal finance guru, Adam Shaw, with us every Monday, and he's certainly here this week. But Laura Hackett joins us now, Deputy Literary Editor at The Times and the Sunday Times, for our Monday afternoon. Kind of just take a deep breath. Just elevate your thoughts. It's our Monday Literary Salon. Yes, Laura, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Why are you smoking?
Well, I was just thinking I can't help anybody with their car finance.
No.
And then what I'm about to say is actually quite useless in many ways.
Car finance is from a very tawdry, real world.
Right.
But we're talking literature with you for the next couple of minutes. You're a very welcome guest. So I don't know where to start this week. Shall we go retro? Because you have mentioned this week, or you want to discuss, a book by the late, great Iris Murdoch. Now, this came out in the early 60s and it's called A Severed Head. Why would I want to read this?
Well, basically, I went on holiday last week and Robbie Millen, my boss, he found out that I hadn't read any Iris Murdoch and he was astonished and horrified. And he said that I had to read A Severed Head. That was his favourite one. And it's interesting because I feel like, not to sort of cast aspersions on Robbie, all the books he recommends me tend to be about sort of hapless men who bad things happen to, but it's quite funny. You know, that's just the connections I'm drawing. He also loves Decline and Fall by Evelyn Waugh. But this one, I promise there isn't actually a severed head in it. You'll be glad to know.
Okay.
It's about a 40-something man, a wine merchant called Martin Lynch Gibbon. He's been reasonably happily married for a while now.
Reasonably happily married.
But he also has a mistress,
of course,
called Georgie. And he thinks this is all very good until his wife comes home and says that she's leaving him. And then what begins is this sort of horrendously farcical story of his mistress and his wife sort of all sleeping with different people who all know each other, and his brother's involved, and then he has a crush on the sister of the man that his wife is leaving him for. And, you know, we were talking a little bit earlier and you said you sometimes find Murdoch's novels claustrophobic. This can be
that. I think
that.
It was my colleague who said that.
It might have been.
It was me.
But yes. It's very funny. It's sort of, it's very farcical and you just have to lean into it and accept it for what it is.
Is it funny, genuinely?
Yeah, I actually did sort of, well, I don't know if I laughed out loud, but I did that thing where you sort of breathe a little bit more heavily through your nose when you're reading.
Okay, I'll take that. Is it set in Hampstead?
It's set across different parts of London. I think part of it's in Islington, which is very classic. Yeah.
It's a bit racist.
Oh, yeah, I know.
Crossing
but
borders.
But it's this came out in 1961, and it very much was Murdoch kind of predicting the sexual revolution that was about to take place. In this novel, it's already happening.
Yeah. Do you think that Robbie Millen's advice was good? Has it slightly changed you having read Sir Iris Murdoch?
I think I will definitely read another one, but she's Marmite. A lot of the novels are like characters sitting and talking about philosophy, and they're all very middle class and they live in exquisitely furnished apartments. And if that bothers you, probably don't go for Iris Murdoch. But I can take a little bit of that sometimes.
It bothers me. It just doesn't entertain me.
No.
Well, there we are. Okay. That's The Severed Head by Iris Murdoch. So it's not been reissued or anything. This is
just the Robbie Millen
recommendation of the week.
Forcing it upon me.
Yes.
I did enjoy it, though, I'll say that.
You're sort of almost convincing me. some writers, and I'm not necessarily saying that Iris Murdoch is one, they just don't always age that well, do they? I mean, what I was thinking the other day about, is it Mary Wesley?
Mm-hmm.
She's not. Is she a similar age, similar vintage?
Probably similar, but not reissued in the way that Iris Murdoch is.
Is, okay, yeah.
So she's the Chamomile Lawn.
That's it.
Isn't
I knew
she?
There was a book by Mary Wesley. Yeah, that was televised and became quite popular.
So
yeah.
I always think that that Iris Murdoch would be very kind of blue stocking reading and Mary Wesley would be very, oh, I've got to be really careful.
More approachable.
Maybe, yes. Yeah. Mm. I think she might be the, you know, the fantastically reasonably priced supermarket versus the slightly pretentious corner shop.
I don't know.
The deli.
Yes.
The gourmet deli.
Yeah,
yes, I
which
see.
Is Iris
I see.
Murdoch.
I think my favourite of the kind of mid-century British women writers is still Elizabeth Jane Hart. Pretty much everything she wrote, I read it and I love.
Really?
Cazalet Chronicles, most
Cazalet
of all.
Chronicles, yeah. There's a really good reading of the Cazalet Chronicles on Audible.
I've been listening to it. We drove up to the Lake District and for the whole of that 6-hour drive, my poor husband was subjected to the Cazalet Chronicles.
Wow.
But he made me listen to one episode of Yes, Minister.
And you only got married relatively recently.
Yeah. Do you know what? I think he's absolutely a keeper. Mm. If he only made you listen to one episode and you were allowed 5.5 hours,
yeah,
this is good,
complain.
Laura. Well done, you.
Thank you.
I did interview Elizabeth Jane Howard. I remember that. I know.
Really?
And I felt very fortunate. To my shame, I hadn't actually read her books. But just in case anybody doesn't know, she was married to Kingsley Amis, wasn't she? And very much, I think, she felt, and certainly her fans felt, that he really overshadowed her and he shouldn't have done.
She was the great genius, I believe.
Thank you, Laura. That was the correct answer. Now, Kate Riley has written a book called Ruth. Why should we? This is new, by the way. Why should we read this?
So it's an absolutely fascinating world that is sort of brought to life in this book. It's set in a Christian communist society. So it's about this girl, Ruth, and it follows her through her whole life from a child until she's much, much older. And so it's a world where there's no property. There's no TV, there's no sort of real possessions. You're given things by the elders who decide what's going to happen. And it's obviously a very strict society as well. You're not really allowed to question things and there's so many rules. But it was really interesting to see that. But at the same time, I sort of felt like that was all it was doing. And I really wanted Ruth to sort of break free of it. Because she's always questioning it. She's a really intelligent young woman, but she doesn't really make any attempt to leave. And I get that that was probably the point of it, that if you grow up in this world, it's very hard to leave, no matter how sort of bright or questioning or doubtful you are. But I was left thinking, I thought this was going to go somewhere that it didn't. Mm. But it is it's a debut novel. It's out just, you know, at the moment. And it's actually, apparently, the author grew up in a sort of similar society to the one that Ruth grows up in. So it's really fascinating.
Where is it set?
It's set in the States, in sort of rural, you know, Midwestern America. And this world, which it seems like it's just in the middle of nowhere. It could be anywhere that it's happening, but that's where it is.
Okay, and this is something that it is an accessible read. This isn't one of those, you know, the narrative jumps from one decade to the next. You're never quite sure who's speaking and there's no punctuation.
It's only Ruth that's speaking and you follow her chronologically through her life. So it's not tricky in that way, but it feels almost like the narrative refuses to go in her head. And I think that's because she's refusing to allow herself to question some things because her whole life would break down. But it can be quite frustrating as a reader because you want to go in there and tell her, like, get out, just run away. But she doesn't.
Okay. Is it a little bit like that book by Tara Westover?
Educated.
Is that...
Yeah, maybe a little bit. I mean, this non-fiction. Is fiction, of course. Yeah. But yeah, it's that kind of world.
It's like a seminar, this, isn't it, Fi?
Yeah, I drifted off.
Oh, great.
Oh, do you know what? I knew that was coming. Becky says, Mary Wesley's very different from Iris Murdoch. Crucially, she says, her first adult novel was published when she was 71. Is that true of Mary? I knew she was quite late to getting published. I don't think it was 71, was
that
it?
That would be a real late bloomer.
My colleague is going to look. She's woken up in the middle of the seminar and she's going
Research
to check
assistant.
That.
It wasn't because I wasn't interested in what you were saying. It's just I was reading some stuff about car finance loans coming up next. Hang on a sec.
I'll tell you what, there's everything here on Times Radio. I love working here. Now, Jonathan Buckley has written a book called One Boat. Actually, it's on the Booker Prize long list. Mm. So what about it?
Yes, well, the Booker Prize long list came out and I, to my shame, realised I'd read one book on the long list, which we sort of guess what the long list will be every year, and every year we get it horrendously wrong, as we did this year.
Right.
So I thought, right, I'd better get around to reading some of these. This is, if you've ever read any Rachel Cusk, it really reminded me of that kind of auto-fiction.
Sorry to interrupt. Rachel Cusk is somebody who minds the minutiae of her own suffering, would it be fair?
I think that would be fair to say. Well, yeah,
but some people love it, some people don't.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, this I don't think is necessarily based on the life of Jonathan Buckley, but it's that kind of writing where you have one character and you're just in their head all the time and you're just seeing everything through their eyes. And maybe they're not necessarily doing that much, they're just having conversations with people, but you've just got to enjoy inhabiting that world. So it's about a woman called Teresa who's gone back to the same Greek town that she visited 9 years ago. Mm-hmm. And the first time she visited it, it was when her mother had died, and now 9 years later, her father has died. So she speaks to kind of all the same people that she spoke to before, and she's reliving that experience. But of course, 9 years on, everything has changed. So it's all about that and what has changed in her mind, the difference between grieving for either of her parents. And at times it can get a little bit repetitive because it's trying to be, and I often find myself confused. Which time am I visiting the town? Is this the earlier or the later, like you were talking about?
You see, you're not. I know you're being very honest about your own view of the book. It does sound to me like the sort of book that's always given prizes, and you know what? Does it actually bring joy to the reader?
Well, that's what I was sort of wondering when I was looking at the Booker Prize long list. I thought, you know, I can see how all of these books are very skilled in their own ways and the way that they're written. Are they necessarily the kinds of books that I would choose to sort of sit down and read for fun? Maybe not. But then again, I haven't read enough of them. So I'm going to work my way through and I'll deliver my verdict. But yeah, I agree with you. It's not the kind of book that I would think, oh, can't wait to pack this on my holiday.
Some news.
But then isn't that what other book prizes are there for? Because, you know, the Booker Prize is up there for big words, hidden meanings, get your head really stuck into something. It's not necessarily the prize that you would go to for I want to lie on a beach and have my head taken to a joyful place. It's just not.
But some books, I think, can do both. Yeah. I mean, when we look back at previous Booker winners, you know, books like Wolf Hall or Bring Up the Bodies, they're not easy books to read, but they're really enjoyable. And I've personally got so much out of them. Or Atonement, or do you know what I mean? There are some books that are really skillfully written, but they also have this brilliant, engrossing story. Those are my favourite. They can do both.
Have you got news about Mary Wesley?
Yes. So our correspondent, Becky, was absolutely right. So she didn't have her first novel published until she was in her 70s. And she was spurred on to write because she was left impoverished after her husband died. And she needed to turn her hand to something to bring in a little bit of money. What a woman.
That's really impressive. Thank you for that message, Becky. We appreciate it. And what are you reading for pleasure at the moment, Laura?
Oh, what am I reading right now? I've just started a novel by Sylvia Townsend Warner, who's a really interesting character. We could talk for half an hour about her, called The Corner That Held Them. And a few months ago, James Marriott, who also works in this building, he said it was the best historical fiction novel he'd ever read. So I thought, well, I've got to give it a go. And it's set in a nunnery, and it follows the same nunnery for 300 years. And it is really fun. But there's like a lot of Black Death in it as well.
Cheers. Right. Laura, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much. That book is called?
The Corner That Held Them.
Right. Thank you very much. Bit of Black Death, bit of nuns, and 300 years of time explored. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
We should say it's Book Club Week in the podcast.
It is. And our special episode goes out on Friday. We've been reading Leonard and Hungry Paul by Ronan Hessian. It's been such a popular choice in the book club. People have really, really loved it. The thing that people like about it is that it is about quiet people. It's about introverts, and it's not a book that relies on twists and drama. It's about the kind of gentle path through life, and it is beautiful. I've really loved reading
it. Yeah, normally when we do the book club, we get some emails from people who say, oh, you know, I really didn't like this, but overwhelmingly there's been love for this book. So if you are looking for a cockle warmer to accompany your beach holiday.
But clever as well. And clever. Really clever about family life.
Brilliantly well observed, actually. So that's Leonard and Hungry Paul out now. And the podcast will be with you later this week. It's also, by the way, going to be televised, that book, next year sometime. Now, Off Air is the podcast. Thank you, Laura, very much indeed. Laura Hackett. Off Air with Jane and Fee is the podcast that Fee and I do Monday to Thursday. And you can join in. It's a wonderful community. Recently, we've been discussing contagious frozen shoulders, the epic TV soap Knots Landing, wills and pensions, and super sewers. We also include in every edition of Off Air an interview that we've done on the programme, although not on Mondays. Do keep up at the back. Recent interviews have been with the likes of Max Hastings. He was very popular. Janet Street Porter, so was she. And a screenwriter, Daisy Goodwin. And last week we spoke to electronic music pioneer Gary Newman, and he told us why he was glad that social media wasn't around when he was famously famous for the first time.
Social media is 90% evil. I mean, it's just an awful burden on all of us. I wish it wasn't there.
Do you think it can connect you to your fans?
If you mentioned anything on social media about anything, you could say the nicest thing, and then somebody will find a problem with it. You know, I don't even have feedback on my social media anymore. It's all turned off. No comments. Don't want to hear. There's too many idiots out there. Too many weird people that just feel they've got to say something horrible. So no, I'm glad it happened when it happened, and I didn't have to have the whole social media thing falling on your shoulders. I sympathise with people today. How many people have killed themselves? They've got a little bit successful. You know, they've been on one of these reality TV shows or something. And suddenly the onslaught of people descends upon them and they go ruin.
That's Gary Newman. It was lovely to meet him on the programme and indeed on the podcast last week. If you would like to be a member of the Off Air with Jane and Fee audio community, all you have to do is listen to it. You can download it, and there are millions of episodes now wherever you get your podcasts from.
Now, phewy, we're just going to talk about cars and money for the rest of the programme. What's happened with car finance over the weekend? Is it the biggest thing since the mis-selling of PPI? Who gets compensation and how do you get your hands on it? Adam Shaw is here to explain. Adam, simple question. Why might people be entitled to £1,000 because of the car they bought and how they bought it?
It's all about how loans were sold to pay for cars, and that involves a lot of people. 90% of cars on the road are bought on finance. We're talking around about 31 million finance agreements made between 2007 and 2021. So this is a hugely important industry. There were complaints that these loans were effectively missold, and that went through a whole series of court cases. At first, the courts said the car loans were missold, and the industry, well, tough luck, you're going to have to pay round about £44 billion to compensate customers. Sharp intake of breath from everyone involved in the industry and a bit of rubbing of hands by the car owners. The Supreme Court now overruled that. However, and this is where it gets a little confusing, that doesn't mean that motorists are going to get nothing. And that's because The moment the Supreme Court said we overrule that, the city regulator, the FCA, said, no, no, a lot of motorists should get around £950. And I think there's been some hugely unhelpful communications by both the courts and the FCA around this. It sounds a bit like Dr. Doolittle's push me, pull you, facing two ways, pulling in opposite directions. So why this apparent confusion? It is because this is not one story. This is two stories. There are two types of car finance mis-selling. There is a commission disclosure complaints issue, which the High Court overruled. And that's basically saying car salespeople should have told you everything you needed to know. They had a fiduciary duty. That's like saying a car salesperson should be an honest person, should tell you everything. And they found that they don't have to do that. They just need to sell you cars. The bit, actually, that the FCA is looking at, and which is the answer to your question, is a different mis-selling issue called discretionary commission arrangements. And that meant some car sales agents sold you a loan and they got more of a commission if they sold you a loan with a higher interest rate. And the FCA has said that needs to be compensated. And the short answer is that is why you might get up to £1,000 if you are on part of that deal.
So is it now up to the companies who were involved in that selling to get in touch with the customers or the other way around?
Good question. The FCA has said it's up to the companies to make the running here. I wouldn't rely entirely on all of this happening. I have to say there's lots of sort of slip between cup and lip, as they say, and you could get lost in the millions of bits of paper that are now going to go all over the place. So I would complain individually. But the emphasis legally is on the company to contact you.
If you've already complained because you thought that you might have been missold, is it worth complaining again?
Complain often, always the rule. It sort of depends, I suppose, on what the reply was. If you have had a reply saying, yes, you have been, you are part of this group, part of this deal, please wait. I don't think there's much point in doing it again. If they have given you an answer you don't believe or not responded properly, like a holding argument, I would complain again. And I have to say, Money Saving Expert website has a standard letter which you could sort of just fill out and send. Very helpful. And that's what I would do. At one point on making a complaint, you'll see lots of adverts for complaint management agencies which will do this on your behalf. Absolutely no need to use them. They might take 30% of any payout you get. And really, it might be that the company contacts you anyway. So at the most, send one of these letters. I really don't see any benefit and only downside in using a management company, despite the adverts you'll be seeing now.
Sure. And just very briefly, Adam, do you have to kind of search back into your memory to the point at which you talked to a person in a car showroom to try and remember whether or not an interest rate was mentioned that you disagree with or whatever? I mean, you know, when you say we were missold, do we know somewhere that we were missold, or would we actually have no idea?
You probably have no idea, because goodness gracious, our lives are packed enough with trying to remember the details of the car loan agreement you signed many years ago. If you've got the paperwork, it should be explicit there. But you should ask them. I mean, there's no reason, just because you can't remember it doesn't put you at any disadvantage. Try and find the paperwork. That would be beneficial. If not, you should make contact, not at first with the people who sold you the car, but who gave you the financing. That's often like Lloyds Bank or big financiers here. It's probably one of the big banks like that, although it might be a smaller company. They're the people who are involved in all of this. If you can't find the paperwork, you can't remember who lent you the money or organized the loan, as a last resort, go to the people who sold you the car and ask them to tell you who the finance was arranged by and if they can provide you with that paperwork.
Adam, thank you very much indeed. That's Adam Shaw, who does Money Matters for us on a Monday afternoon. And it's pretty simple advice, really, isn't it? Just bother. Don't leave it as one of those things where you don't bother to do this. It may well be you that was missold without you ever realising it. It's definitely worth putting in a complaint.
Yep. Thank you very much for that, Adam. It's Times Radio, 4 minutes to 4.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing, with intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Listen to Times Radio on your smart speaker. Just say, play Times Radio.
Ah, claim approved. Direct Line's ready to send my new laptop within 2 hours. That's how it's done. Imagine if that's how everything got done. Like teaching little Johnny to play his recorder.
Oh, my.
That's my boy!
Direct Line. That's how it's done.
Theft and accidental loss claims up to £3,000. Cover limits apply. Personal possessions cover needed for items outside the home.
At Kia, we're excited to announce that the refined new Kia Sportage is available in showrooms now. Secure your test drive today to explore its advanced technology and stylish, sporty design. Order before the 30th of September to get 5.9% APR representative and £1,000 PCP finance deposit contribution. Search the new Kia Sportage to book your test drive. T's and C's apply. Kia Finance.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
Looking to grow your investments and generate a long-term income? The Scottish American Investment Company, also known as Saints, could help. Saints has been investing for over 150 years and focuses on growing capital as well as income by investing in a diverse range of companies from around the world. Saints is managed by Bailey Gifford, manager for some of the UK's best-known investment trusts. Find out key information and more at baileygifford.com. As with any investment, capital is at risk and income is not guaranteed.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Callum MacDonald joins you here on Times Radio between 4 o'clock and 7. He is in shorts. He will be interviewing his own father. But apart from that...
Sold. I'd listen to that.
Well, I would. We should say, in all fairness, before your show starts, you may as well do a bit of overtime. He's on the Isle of Lewis.
Correct, yes.
So he's in the eye of the storm.
Yeah, it's not been. It's got worse this afternoon. I will chat to him in a minute or two. But I've had pictures this afternoon of trees down, falling on cars, and a video actually of lots of boats in harbour. I think this was in Ullapool, actually. Yes, in Ullapool, and it looks wild in the harbour, which famously should be the sheltered part of the sea, and it's really, really not. So yeah, it's quite bad.
Okay. Can I just squeeze in a very quick text from Sam, the rained-off Cornish gardener who's never had a car loan? Come to Cornwall in the winter. Half the cars, including mine, will be worth £1,500 or less and owned outright. Bit tatty round the edges for being slung in a hedge down narrow lanes, like myself.
I'm sure you're underselling yourself there.
There's more, but I thought just for dramatic purposes, I'd finish it there, Sam. I hope that's okay.
You've got me hanging. I want to know more. We'll be back, whether you like it or not, tomorrow afternoon at around 2 o'clock, and indeed at exactly 2 o'clock, and Callum MacDonald will guide you through the evening. Have a good one. It is almost 4 o'clock.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Hello, good afternoon. It's 4 o'clock. This is Callum MacDonald sitting in for John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive. The headlines: Storm Floris brings winds of more than 100 miles per hour, causing travel disruption across Scotland. And Israel's planning a military operation in an effort to release the remaining hostages held by Hamas in central Gaza. Coming up on Drive, former Russian Prime Minister turned Kremlin critic Mikhail Kasyanov will discuss his view on the seeming growing tension between his former boss, Vladimir Putin, and President Trump, and how many sewage spills are potentially illegally dumped into our rivers by water companies. The Times Environment editor has the data, and spoiler alert, it's pretty grim.
This is Times Radio.
Right now, let's get the latest news. Here's Tom Crosdale.
Thanks, Callum. Good afternoon. Storm Floris has brought gusts of more than 100 miles per hour, causing travel disruption in northern parts of the UK. A number of rail lines in Scotland have been blocked by falling trees, including one near Cornton in Stirling, while bridges are closed, including the A1 Tynebridge in East Lothian. A road in the Western Highlands is blocked after a camper van overturned, and some ferry sailings have been cancelled. Forecaster Jim Dales told Times Radio, summer storms are unpredictable.
No storms are ever the same. They hit different areas, they do different things. Whether we're talking damage or, sadly, casualties, we will see by the end of it. The last one that we had in August was Storm Lillian, only last year. I would say that they are unusual, August storms, but since 2020, we've actually seen five of them, so they're not that unusual.
Around 30,000 properties in Scotland and the Republic of Ireland are without power. The Israeli army is understood to be planning a new operation that would see forces go into central Gaza to release the remaining hostages being held by Hamas. The IDF has previously avoided such an operation in case it puts those being held captive in danger. But Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says it's clear Hamas doesn't want a deal that would include their release. Veteran radio presenter James Whale has died. He was 74 and had kidney cancer. James pioneered the late-night radio phone-in and more recently had a show on our sister station Talk. In 2024, he was awarded an MBE for his services to broadcasting and charity.
If I have a few more months, that will be great. If I have until next Christmas or this coming Christmas, will be nice, wouldn't it? But if I die tomorrow, I've had an amazing time and I married an amazing lady.
Scotland's Deputy First Minister Kate Forbes has announced she won't be running for re-election as an SNP next year. She says she doesn't want to miss any more of the precious early years of family life. Katrina Stewart is a political correspondent in Scotland and has told Times Radio it comes as a surprise.
Kate Forbes is a prominent figure in the SNP. She is well respected and she had been approved for standing again for the Holyrood election next year. So this has really come out of the blue in the middle of recess, and it leaves big questions about what John Swinney is going to do next, what's next for the SNP, and whether the reasons that she's given are on the surface of it, the real reasons, or whether there is something else going on behind the scenes.
England have been denied an historic victory as India got a dramatic 6-run win in the final test at the Oval. Chasing just 35 runs on the final day, the hosts collapsed, losing 4 wickets in an hour. Former England bowler Steve Harmison says the series, which ends 2-all, has shown us the best of test cricket.
It is alive, it has been a great series and it will be remembered for quite a lot of things. Some close finishing, some individual brilliance, but also some spikiness as well. They've been really having a go at each other, these two, which I think we've all enjoyed, and that's what made the series better. But I think all in all, it just shows the best format of the game is the test format of the game because it challenges you the most.
Steve Harmison there. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker.
Times Radio Drive with Barclays Business Banking.
Hello, good afternoon. It's 4 minutes past four on Monday afternoon. It's the 4th of August. Welcome to Times Radio Drive with Callum MacDonald while John Pienaar enjoys some sun-filled holiday. We'll uphold his reputation for analysis and conversation and breaking news between now and 7 o'clock here on Times Radio. Since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February 2022, we've all been trying to keep up with the rapidly changing nature of warfare. We talk of drone strikes from hundreds of miles away impacting both sides of the conflict. We're well beyond President Trump's promise to conclude the conflict within 24 hours of taking his seat at the Resolute desk in the Oval Office, but we're closing in on his latest deadline. He's shortened the leash from which President Putin of Russia consistently breaks free. If by the 8th of August Russia hasn't signed up to a ceasefire in Ukraine, it will face more sanctions. So, in theory, will countries that buy Russian oil. But is Putin showing any signs of shifting from his surging drone warfare? How do you argue against and convince the Russian president to change approach? A former Russian prime minister will tell us on Drive this afternoon. Elsewhere, the Deputy First Minister of Scotland, Kate Forbes, will not seek re-election as an SNP MSP at next May's election. She's standing down to spend more time with her family. Her daughter's just turned 3 years old. Today, then, a renewed focus on the difficulties politicians face when deciding whether to persevere or reconsider their career. Ms Forbes was almost the First Minister of Scotland. The SNP never recovered from the divisive campaign in which she competed to succeed Nicola Sturgeon. In some ways, the party has never recovered from Nicola Sturgeon. Our guests will reflect on politicians with whom they've worked and tell us how they knew it was time to depart. The latest on Storm Floris comes next, and you can keep in touch with us on 87222 if you're texting and start your message with the word Times, or you can WhatsApp us on 0333 003 2353. It is always lovely to hear from you. You're the most important part of our programme this afternoon. At least 22,500 homes are without power in Scotland after being buffeted by winds of over 80 miles per hour. That's strong enough to knock you off your feet and cause serious damage to buildings and trees. Over 73 miles per hour counts as a hurricane on the Beaufort wind scale. An amber weather warning remains in place across large parts of Scotland for the next 7 hours. Let's start our coverage with Claudia Rowan, travel writer for The Times and The Sunday Times. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Just give us a sense then of how bad this thing is.
So it's no overstatement to say that it is causing chaos, particularly in Scotland, but also spots across Northern England, Northern Ireland and Wales. There have been widespread flight cancellations, train cancellations, particularly in Scotland. Roads are blocked, some key bridges are closed, and there are extreme winds in a lot of places. So it is not a fun time to be travelling in Scotland today.
Indeed, travel has been really severely disrupted, in fact. Trains, planes, ferries, all affected.
Exactly. At least 40 flights have been cancelled across Scotland and Northern Ireland today, including BA services to and from Heathrow today and Gatwick as well. Hundreds of trains have been cancelled across Scotland and Northern England. LNER has advised no travel north of Newcastle. Avanti as well, no travel north of Preston. So hundreds of trains have been cancelled. It's not a great day to be travelling on the train.
Very much a batten down the hatches sort of situation. In terms of damage and disruption elsewhere, trees down, caravans being blown over, that sort of thing.
Exactly. It is quite extreme, it seems. Numerous roads have been closed due to fallen trees and debris. There have been camper vans overturned on routes like the A87. Bridges such as the Tyne Bridge and others remain restricted.
In terms, Claudia, of how we were prepared for this, it did seem like warnings were issued, that they were loud,